Now, the marathon is very much on our minds, even if some of us have just been sitting on our backsides for most of the day. And I'm sure we are very impressed with the idea of people running all that way. But how some people can manage to dress up as Darth Vader, or a bottle of Lucozade, or 17 runners tied together, I just can't imagine. And there's no knowing the questions they will be asked by television reporters, some actually during the race itself. For example, are you in pain? How does it feel to be the fastest Elvis Presley? And is the hair specifically for the occasion? Overall, not the greatest set of questions, probably. Anyway, we're going to find that two questions dominate the last half of John chapter 21. And one of those two was a very good one, absolutely spot on, as we shall see. And the other one actually wasn't. But both these questions open up key relationships for those who choose to follow Jesus Christ, including us today. And at the time, both of them involved Peter. Now, Peter, as you may have discovered if you've read the Gospels for yourself, you'll know that he was what we call accident-prone. Never boring, he would liven up any dull party, and years later you could spend many an entertaining evening with old friends recalling his exploits. Do you remember when he said that? Do you remember when he did that? Those ideas he came up with? Unfortunately, most of the time, Jesus was there at hand. He was around to rescue him from drowning. He was there to rebuke him when he overstepped the mark. And Jesus was also there to repair the damage when Peter sliced an ear off the servant of the high priest. And that could have turned nasty. So Peter was irrepressible. You just couldn't hold him down. And a catalogue of disasters he managed to achieve, but also great moments of genius. And he did have this knack of coming up with some brilliant answers when everybody else was afraid to speak. And no one could fault Peter for his sheer enthusiasm. In fact, despite everything, Jesus was grooming him for leadership until one day when it all seemed to fall apart. He had sworn he would never, ever deny or disown Jesus. And a few hours later, he was swearing that he never even knew him. And so it all ended in tears, and he was a failure. And Peter felt so bad because he had promised so much. But sadly, none of us can ensure against failure. And then came Jesus' resurrection, and at the start of this chapter, chapter 21, Peter announced that he was going to go fishing. He was a fisherman by profession, and he managed to find six others who would go with him. And they fished all night, and to say that the result was disappointing was an understatement, because they actually caught nothing at all. And you'll see that if you're glancing down the first few verses of this chapter. But then, the gloom lifts, when they discover that the person who's been calling to them from the beach was the risen Jesus Christ. And suddenly everything changed. And after a cooked breakfast, Jesus has this, our first question that we're considering tonight, the first of the two that he asked Simon Peter. Simon, do you love me? And that question, which we find, as we have in front of us, verses 15 to 17, dominates. And we're going to let it do the same this evening for ourselves. Do you love me? It was a question from Jesus. So often it is us asking Jesus the questions. We ask him, what does this mean? Can we believe that? Why did you do that? Why am I suffering in this way? And Jesus is patient with our questions. But sometimes he takes his rightful place and he puts his question to us, like this one. It is addressed not only to a chosen few, but to all of us. Jesus asked the question, do you love me? So it was a question from Jesus. It was also a very serious one. Do you love me? And don't imagine that this was a soft, purely emotional, gentle inquiry. Think of a husband or wife, possibly a parent or child, asking that question. It's not saying, how about a big present, or a romantic evening out, or a few words of appreciation, or a half-hearted apology. That's not what they're looking for. They need to know that their parent, their child, their husband or their wife is prepared to give them 100% allegiance and loyalty. And so it is with Jesus. Peter, he asks, as it were, will you suffer with me if necessary? Will you accept my authority over the whole of your life? I am being straight with you. I expect you to be straight with me. Do you love me? It was also a repeated question. You may notice as you look through these verses that the translation we have in front of us, the New International Version, tries to do justice to the different Greek words for love that are in these few verses by translating truly love in some places and simply love in others. And if you've been present in other churches hearing somebody talk about this particular passage, you may have discovered that some preachers and writers too have gone to town on the significance of these differences, leaving their listeners either impressed or bewildered or sometimes both. But it's probably a diversion, because the author of the Gospel often switches between words and means absolutely nothing by that. And what is significant is that Jesus is asking the same question three times. And when you look down and you see in verse 17 that Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" That time it's not that he was embarrassed with the other disciples hearing it again, but probably anguish at knowing that Jesus, in asking him the third time, is actually reminding him of that awful night when three times he denied Jesus. So it was repeated three times. It was a comprehensive question as well. If you look in verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, do you truly love me more than these?" These what? Now John doesn't actually tell us these what. It depends where Jesus waves his hand as he speaks. Was he waving his hand towards the fishermen, perhaps, meaning, "Do you love me more than these disciples do?" Or is Jesus pointing to the fish and to the boats, in effect asking, will Peter go back to giving priority to the way of life associated with his pre-Jesus days? Do you love me more than that? But we can't see his hand. But it doesn't matter, because Jesus had in mind either or both, encompassed in asking, "Do you love me?" When I began studying theology as a young man, a minister I knew quite well wrote to me very kindly, and he said, "Do you remember that love of the Lord Jesus is far more important than any amount of academic books?" Now, of course, I had to get stuck into the books, but he was drawing attention to the question of Jesus, "Do you love me?" So let's take another view on these three verses, concentrated on this one question. And as we look at them, we find that contained, there's quite a package here. There's the interview, there's the job description, there's the commissioning, and there was the salary. The interview, we've already seen that there was only one question, which is unusual for a start. And Peter gives the same answer each time. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Peter is, in effect, saying to Jesus, "Don't just watch my lips, look into my heart." And surely that is what Jesus wanted. Yet he knew also that it was good for Peter to say clearly to everybody else and to himself, so that people were left in no doubt. And we can all learn a lesson from that. We don't just assume that somehow we have told Jesus that we love him. What about the job description? Well, it's very clearly here. Jesus said in verse 15 and so on, "Feed my lambs," or "feed my sheep," meaning again very much the same thing. In other words, take care of them. Take care of my people. And already Peter and the others have seen the fish in the first part of the chapter, which was a vivid reminder of when Jesus said, "I will make you fishers of men." So Peter had two jobs. One was to spread the gospel to people, and the other was to take care of them. And by taking care, it was to protect them, to warn them, to teach them, to encourage them, to support them. He was to be a pastor as well as an evangelist. And within our own limit, shouldn't we all? When I spent a week in a local hospital, again when I was quite young, very close to where I was a young Christian minister, there was on the ward a sister of what I might call the traditional variety, with a very commanding voice. And she, with that voice, suggested that I should have the privilege of a side ward, being local clergy. I protested that I was very happy to stay in the main ward. "Oh," said the sister, so that everybody could hear, "oh, you want to be with your flock." Now, I didn't dare to say anything, but just reflecting on the passage now, Jesus reminds Peter they would not be Peter's flock. Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." There's no real hierarchy. We are all his sheep. But do remember that Peter was the failure. There's no record here of Jesus specifically forgiving Peter. But if we ever have doubts about coming back after our own failures, then Rita Snowden answered our secret, anxious question when she wrote, "You ask me what forgiveness means. It is the wonder of being trusted again by God in the place where I disgraced him." The commissioning. Jesus doesn't ask Peter, "Will you do this?" Because if we say yes to the question, "Do you love me?" then it is assumed that we will do whatever he seems to want us to do, and that we will go wherever he seems to be wanting us to go. What about the salary? Now, if you have been looking hard to try and find it here, you will see that no sums are mentioned. But Jesus does give us a clue about working conditions. There's no attempt to make the job sound attractive or even palatable. On the contrary, what he says to Peter is what we find in verses 18 and the beginning of 19. "I tell you the truth," Jesus said to Peter, "when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. When you're old, you will stretch out your hands and somebody else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." And if we're not quite sure what that means, Jesus tells us in the very next verse. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. It promised to be a tough life, leading to a very tough death. And as Christians answering the call to follow Jesus, we don't expect perks. We're not enticed with favors. There was a book called At Any Cost. You may have read it. And it left a deep impression on me in my early 20s. It was the true story of a man and his wife who worked as Christian missionaries in northern Thailand. And shortly before their son was born, the man was murdered. Some years later, a student lodged with us in Manchester. And after he had been with us for a while, we discovered that he was that son. Jesus had already said to Peter, "If anybody would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross and follow me." Contemporary historians confirmed that Peter was martyred. And the words of Jesus tell us that he met his death through crucifixion. Now, we spent quite a lot of time on that, but it's a very important question, and it was the question that Jesus asked Peter, "Do you love me?" But there's another question, and this time it concerns not so much Peter and Jesus, although of course Jesus was there, but Peter and John, and we find this in verses 20 up to 25. So our first question was put by Jesus to Peter, one he insists on asking three times over. And that provides the basis for our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. But now Peter tries to change the focus to another disciple who is following behind them. Have a look at verse 20. "Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. And when Peter saw him, he asked, 'Lord, what about him?'" Now obviously this question isn't in the same class as the other one. But as we look at it and we see how Jesus reacted, it gives us a glimpse, a clue to the relationship that we have with our brother and sister Christians, especially as Jesus deliberately refuses to answer it. To Peter it seemed a very reasonable question. He'd been hearing what was going to happen to him. What about the guy behind? And Jesus told Peter it was irrelevant what was going to happen to the man behind, at least irrelevant to him, and he quickly kicked it into touch. You see in verse 22, Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." In the days before marathons became races for thousands of the general public, there was a much smaller craze for the London to Brighton walk. 56 miles from Tower Hill down the A23 to the pier at Brighton. And I set off with about 500 other walkers, Very few of us, I suspect, have done any training at all, or certainly nothing serious. And therefore, we were intent only on making the finish within the allocated time. And by doing that, gain a point for our team. Now, I don't remember being bothered how others were getting on until about a mile from the end, at which point my feet were killing me. And at that point, I was passed by two men, one being guided by the other, because it was evident that he was totally blind. And I was shocked. He was overtaking me, and he couldn't even see where he was going. Now, we've learnt a lot about the courage and sporting abilities of the physically disabled since those days. So, yes, if we come back to what is happening in this incident with Jesus and Peter and John, so, yes, we are taught not to be distracted by anything or anybody when we answer the call of Jesus to follow him. The New Testament teaches us to run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus. But having determined to do that, what kind of relationship are we to have with those running the same Christian race as we are? Now, before we tackle that, there is, of course, the mystery of the identity of this beloved disciple, not called by name, but by the phrase, the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, we haven't time to discuss all the options. The issues are quite complex, and external evidence has to be taken into account, and the detail of the gospel to be studied in order to do justice to the various arguments. But simply taking the chapter that we have in front of us for the moment, from verse 24, many conclude that this disciple, known as the one whom Jesus loved, is the same person as the author of this gospel. Verse 24, this is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down, and we know that his testimony is true. And given the fact shown in verse 2 that this disciple whom Jesus loved, who was obviously intimately known to Jesus, it shows us there that this disciple was one of only seven, a group which included John and James, the sons of Zebedee. And a process of elimination makes it reasonable, along with other evidence, to suggest that the disciple whom Jesus loved, the author of this gospel, and John, one of the sons of Zebedee, were one and the same person. And we can be assured we're in good theological company when we believe that this is the most likely to be the case. But what is Jesus in this passage from John's Gospel telling us about our relationship with other brothers and sisters? The first, I think, is that we accept that we are going to have different jobs. Now, in verse 22, Jesus implies that John's life would not be cut short. It seems he would go on teaching and reflecting and writing with the prime purpose of leaving this marvelous legacy of the crafted, profound gospel and the letters in the New Testament, these documents that have been such an eye-opener to millions over centuries. That was primarily what John was being called to do. And that wasn't the same, it seems, as Peter. And today some people think that God is calling to ministry abroad or in London or in the inner city, supported financially by other people. Some think that God wants them to serve him in what is sometimes termed secular employment. And Mark Green has done as much as anybody to make us realize that God has placed his people not only in churches to work here, based here, but in the workplace, meaning home, or office, or school, or university, or factory. And we have no reason to give the impression that it is more important to be a Christian as a minister than to be a Christian at work anywhere else. Jesus gives us different places in which to work and different work to do. And so Jesus, in this way, doesn't want us to judge one another. He does expect that wherever we are, whatever we do, we are there in order to follow him. So we accept we have different jobs. And then secondly here, we're content with different lots. The danger of Peter's curiosity about John was one of comparison. When we compare our lot with somebody else's, we can, if we're not very careful, become discontented with our own. Now, it wouldn't be easy for Peter. As one commentator wrote, what is remarkable is that Peter lived several decades with this prediction about his death hanging over him. It looked as though John, on the other hand, would be spared all that, that he could expect to live to a ripe old age. What about today? Well, one follower of Jesus perhaps appears to us to live in luxury, a country mansion, frequent holidays to paradise destinations, a large salary, with an adoring wife, and six obedient, gifted, and of course very successful children. And no amount of, well, I'm sure he has problems we don't know about, would equal things out. And sometimes it may feel very unfair when we allow ourselves to dwell on it. So secretly we might be asking sometimes, Lord, what about him? And Jesus turns to us and he says, and what is that to you? Follow me. Hard for Peter, but the right answer. Hard for us sometimes, I'm sure, but again, the right answer. Now, don't jump to the wrong conclusions because of the point that Jesus is making here. The New Testament never expects us to cut ourselves off from other people and always to work and to live independently, just doing our own thing. On the contrary, Dr. David Lee wrote for many years on this subject, he said, I bought into the idea that relationships just happened. I seemed to start relationships on more or less the same haphazard way as I caught colds. Now, a relationship with Christ is not like that, and nor should it be the case for those with whom we work. Peter and John were different personalities, with different roles and different futures. And yet, when we turn to the book of Acts, we see that they ministered together, they were in prison together, they shared leadership together, positively enjoying their different gifts together. As Christians, we can be guilty of giving others a hard time, watching their every move, judging their every word. And Jesus urges us not, as Peter was tempted to do, not to be looking over our shoulder, comparing our lot with somebody else's, but responding to the loving call of Jesus when he says, as for you, follow me. The very last verse some people think is a bit of an odd ending, but funny. In fact, some people prefer the one at the end of chapter 20. You can have a look over at that. Now, it does seem that chapter 21 could have been written by John a bit later and added on, and that's why it appears to be a bit of an epilogue. We're not really quite sure. But in any case, verse 25 at the end of the very last chapter is a good, if different, kind of finish. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. This is no grand or reasoned statement of faith. John signs off, leaving us thinking, wow. He's not simply calculating that the universal library is too small. He's simply registering that Jesus is too great. He knows, as an author, he's only dipped his toe into the subject of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So much more could be said about this Jesus. And when John eventually lays down his pen, he realizes that having written a little about Jesus, he is lost in wonder and love and praise.